Hi, this is Bob Enyar. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store, and there are two fabulous DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. These are by a dear friend of Real Science Radio, Spike Pisaris. And Spike has created simply the greatest astronomy DVDs ever produced. And we have gone through probably hundreds of science DVDs and books, and we recommend only the very best at our store, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store. You'll love these astronomy DVDs, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy, Volume 1 and Volume 2. You got to get them.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, from the current issue of Creation Magazine, we're going to go out of the pages of the Bible right to the world's leading scientific journal, the journal Nature. And we'll notice that the transition, there's hardly a hiccup.
It's a smooth transition from the Bible to Nature magazine.
It is so fun. And so
here's more confirmation of the Bible, right?
Yeah.
This is amazing.
In every imaginable and wonderful way.
That's right.
The editors of Creation Magazine, they point out that over the years, when they talk about how old the earth is and how long human beings have been here, how many generations do they say since Adam and Eve until today have there been of humans?
Oh, 200 generations. I've heard that for years.
I've heard that for like 200 generations. They've been saying, and it's in print, 200 generations, and they say that in this issue. The first article, they say, we have periodically pointed out that from a biblical perspective, there have only been about 200 human generations. That's from the chronology out of the pages of the Bible.
Yeah, and using some population genetics on how long a generation lasts. So
Well, you
do the math, and it comes out to about 200.
About 200.
Yeah, pretty good estimate.
So now you get to today in the journal Nature, which is the mother lode of evolutionary dogma, the journal Nature. And what it says in here, Fred, there's an article where they analyze 6,500 sections of DNA. And what they find in that article is just so fun.
Yeah, it is. They comment that most of the mutations that we found arose in the last 200 generations or so.
No, 200.
Imagine that. Where did they come up with that number?
And this happens all the time.
It happens all the time.
It is so fun.
Yes.
To see that even though they hate the scriptures, and they do, and they hate Jesus Christ, they affirm what he taught, that God made us male and female at the beginning of the creation, which was only thousands of years ago.
That's right.
Otherwise, most of our mutations would have arisen over the last, like, 4 million years.
Yeah, so they all seem to have started about 200 generations ago.
Yeah.
Imagine that, somewhere around the time of the fall of creation.
And they say most of these mutations, that's from their evolutionary perspective. If they took off those glasses and they could see clearly, with a creationist perspective, they'd find out that all the mutations in the coding, these 6,500 exomes, they're called, they're the regions of the DNA that are expressed. So they'd find out that all of those mutations are accounted for in the last 200 generations or so.
That's right. So Adam and Eve started out with how many mutations?
Zero.
Zero. Zero mutations.
Yeah. It's sort of like the universe, the entropy has been increasing in the universe. We did a show on this years ago. It's like for the entropy, the disorder in the universe to be increasing, the disorder is increasing. It had to start with this tremendous high state of order. And so our DNA, it's decreasing. It's mutating. The mutational load eventually
it's getting worse.
Go extinct eventually.
So this reminds me of probably the most asked question of both from both creationists and evolutionists.
Mm.
Where did Cain get his wife?
Cain married one of his sisters.
Ooh, it was one of his sisters?
Yes.
Wait a minute. Isn't that incest?
It was healthy, good, and right when God created Adam and Eve because they did not have the destructive genetic deterioration that came in rapidly over the next thousands of years. So that Abraham married his sister.
Yeah. And they so God didn't outlaw incest until after the flood, right? After the bottleneck
after
the flood.
And to the time of Moses.
That's right. So after the flood, there was a bottleneck effect. And slowly the mutations then grew more rapidly and eventually got to the point where those kind of close relations caused too many problems because of these genes that could be expressed where parents have a copy of a bad mutation and the odds start increasing. And so God said, hey, no more.
So your child, your baby who you love will have a genetic defect, mutation, even a lethal birth defect. And so out of love, which is why God regulates as he does and commands, out of love, God said you no longer could have relations with close family members.
That's right. But in the beginning, you could because there was no genetic load.
And so, Fred, why doesn't natural selection weed out all this mutational load? I mean, you have species that are going extinct because of the breakdown in their genomes. And this is a serious problem. Some of the world's leading geneticists are warning people about how bad things are and how worse they'll become. So if natural selection, the entire claim of natural selection, it's like the princess who could feel a pea under her mattress, it could build up the patterns to retain the patterns on your fingerprint ridges. To keep them the same your whole life. It could do all that, and it can't get rid of these mutations.
It can't. You know, John Sanford wrote a great book called Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome, one of my favorite books. Mm. And he talks about this.
He's from Cornell.
Yeah, Cornell, PhD geneticist. And he used that analogy of the princess and the pea. You know, it's like, how does natural selection detect a change at that bad mutations at that level? Natural selection can only select individuals. It can't select a gene somewhere. It can't even see it. And you've got so many of these bad mutations that are building up, can't select them out of the population.
Right.
They outpace anything that would be called beneficial. Beneficial mutations are exceedingly rare.
And I heard a talk he gave and he said, okay, natural selection. Let's say it works 100% perfectly. Everyone in this auditorium, next generation, only the 50% of us, the half of us that are the most fit will have children. The rest, forget it, you're all dead, right?
Yeah.
And so that happens. Now, your children are going to be less fit than you are because of mutations and the genetic load on the species. He said it doesn't matter if natural selection, if it actually did select the most fit, which it doesn't, but if it did, every generation is going to get worse anyway, and that's because of the fall, as the creation editors quote from Paul's epistle to the Romans, chapter 8, that the cosmos, the world, is in bondage to decay, and everything is deteriorating. Fred, this is a serious problem, for one, for public policy issues and health, but for two, for Darwinism. It doesn't work.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, what about error correction? Isn't there an error correction mechanism in the genome that fixes mistakes? So if a mistake, a mutation occurs, God designed this really elaborate error correction system that
brilliant,
is beyond description.
It's human brilliance.
Absolutely.
And that's so that when our cells reproduce, which they do trillions of times, and when you have offspring, each process has to copy your whole genome. So we're talking for humans, 3 billion bits of information copied, and it needs to be accurate. Because it's a physical process, there are mistakes. Your DNA and your living cell together have this combined ability to do error correction every time you duplicate your nucleus.
Yeah, that's right. There's this other process working at the same time when the cell splits.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. So did that start off as a robust error correction system back millions of years ago?
Fred,
where did that come from?
What a dilemma you've just put your finger on for the Darwinist marketing reps like Richard Dawkins and P.Z. Myers and these guys we spar with like Jerry Coyne. Even with this elaborate error correcting mechanism, we still have this crisis of mutations and birth defects and all. And that's with the elaborate error correcting genetic mechanisms.
Which itself should be breaking down slightly too, right?
And it is. Isn't there evidence?
There is evidence of that. Certain diseases that have been associated with the breakdown of the error correction mechanism.
Which makes sense, right? Because the Bible says everything is in decay. Everything is breaking down. So here's the dilemma you just put your finger on, and I'd like to challenge any Darwinist to answer this one. How is it that the genomes of these simpler organisms were going to build up and increase in sophistication when they didn't have error correcting mechanisms. I mean, the reason you would need error correcting mechanisms is because there are errors. And if you don't have an error correcting mechanism, there are going to be a lot of errors.
Yeah.
How are you going to evolve by random chance? Natural selection won't even select for error correction until it's starting to work.
Yeah.
It has to be pure random blind chance. Until it's starting to work, and error correction is wildly sophisticated. So how do you go from no error correction to some error correction? It's another example of insanity.
It is.
Among
it
really Darwinists. Is.
Yeah.
These Darwinian marketing reps cannot be trusted. They're salesmen and they're selling snake oil. Fred, I love this quote here from a Cornell University population geneticist. And he says, and the whole field of population genetics is in total crisis. But aside from that, he says humans today carry a much larger load of deleterious variants, i.e. mutations, than our species carried just prior to its massive expansion just a couple hundred generations ago. Okay, so all
massive
this
expansion, and you know, about the time of Adam and Eve, there's a massive expansion of the human race.
Remember, Ann Gibbons wrote that article.
Oh, absolutely.
The mitochondrial clock, and that humans, it looks like Eve lived about 6,000 years ago.
Yeah, their original data was something like 500,000 years. They didn't have very much data, and they got this new pile of data in.
Yeah, and they looked at just the human data, not mixing the chimp data.
That's right. That's right.
And they said, well, if you do it that way, it looks like Eve lived about
a mere 6,000 years old.
Years ago.
And of course, her next sentence was, of course, this cannot be the case.
Of course not.
Data. In your evolutionary worldview and your lens.
Well, then what did you put it for in this?
Yeah.
Why'd you report it? If you know it's a mistake, normally you don't report your mistakes.
But over and over again,
when you know it.
Yeah. The data keeps coming in and fitting with the biblical timeline, a timeline that is not millions of years.
No.
It's a timeline that suggests that, hey, the world's really old, Bob. It's 6,000 years is really old.
That is pretty old.
That is pretty
old. It's dinosaur soft tissue old. It's
carbon
14 everywhere old.
Yeah.
That's how old it is. Fred, I mentioned that the whole field of population genetics is in crisis. And I mean the whole field. Because for one, remember Haldane's dilemma? We did a whole show on that.
Oh, yeah,
Walter
absolutely.
Remine.
And that's where I'd seen some of the 200 generations before in the math with all that population genetics, you know, when that thing reared its head.
Yeah, and Haldane, J.B.S. Haldane, is one of the world's leading evolutionists, population geneticists. And he says, you know, guys, we have quite a problem here. It's Haldane's dilemma. We don't really know how to solve it, but we can effectively ignore it. We can do that. But Fred, back then, in the ignorant days of population genetics, they thought that one gene coded for one feature, and it was sort of like the cartoon version of science.
Oh, yeah.
One gene, one feature. So it's so simple to model your Darwinian evolution, and you have a mutation in one gene, and it gives you this one little, like 0.5% survival advantage, and so then the whole species gets better. Well, first of all, even when you took their extraordinarily favorable assumptions, which as creationists, we always take the assumptions that make our claim the most difficult. They always take the most favorable.
Exactly.
When you take the most favorable, they still, in like a million years, all they could get is like 1,000 mutations.
Yeah, actually it was 10 million years. They could get about 1,000 beneficial mutations.
Right. About 1,000.
Yeah.
And you need millions to go from a chimp to a human.
Yeah.
Millions in half that time. But now, we know that it's not one gene codes for one feature. That's a mythology. That was the cartoon version of genetics. And that's the basis of those population genetics models.
Yeah, they assume that when actually many genes can affect polygenetic traits. There's also epistatic genes that control other genes.
Ah.
And so, you know, many genes affect one trait.
Right.
And you get one mutation in one of those genes, it's going to be so-called helpful. What about all those other mutations that are happening in those other genes?
Right.
Is it really going to improve the organism?
Right. It's like taking your iPad and just randomly changing some of the bits in the operating system because you want the next model.
Yeah.
You want a better iPad.
To me, it's like the national debt, you know, growing tremendously.
Yeah.
So let's say that we took $1 out of the public debt for education, but they're still going to increase it by some huge amount.
Yeah.
So that's how evolution is supposed to work. These occasional, very exceedingly rare beneficial changes.
You lose a little on every sale, but you make it up in quantity.
Yeah.
Right. Fred, the opening music that our longtime friend Tony Funderburk wrote for Real Science Radio, he says that intelligent design and DNA, they just can't explain it all away. And one of the world's leading atheists, remember, atheist philosopher, he gave up on his atheism.
He sure did. Anthony Flew, very popular atheist, and towards the latter years of his life, he realized that there must be some sort of designing God. Mm. And this was based off of molecular genetics.
When he looked at molecular biology, cellular biology, and this sent shockwaves through the world of militant atheism, so that when you look at molecular biology, cellular biology, you realize that the designer had to be not just a very smart human being, but this transcendent being who could comprehend and then implement this wild sophistication beyond anything we still could imagine. And so Anthony Flew said, look, guys, we lost. They won. Yeah. You know, when the scientist finally gets to the summit, he finds the theologians already there.
Yeah. And, you know, it sent shockwaves through the atheist community. You know, some of them said that he was going senile.
Yeah.
You know, others said that, well, the co-author, who was a Christian, he put words in his mouth and this and that. And this article mentions the posthumous letters that defends the fact that this converted atheist actually did say these words.
Yeah. In fact, he wrote a slew of letters that are now public, and he spoke openly about his book, what it would be about, the points it would make. And so once again, you know, they are desperate.
They are desperate. So what we're dealing with here is an evolutionist cuckoo's nest that Anthony Flew over. Okay, that was bad. Well, you know, this next article is about cuckoo's nest. I think we're a cuckoo's nest. We're getting dumber.
The whole human race is getting dumber and dumber. And this is a Stanford scientist who is doing this research. He says humans are getting less intelligent. This is the worldview that the Bible presents.
That's right. And so, again, here's another article about how we're slowly deteriorating over time, and it says we're getting dumber.
And this is from Stanford University. A recently published paper estimates that in the last 3,000 years, and that's about 120 generations, every person has sustained two or more mutations harmful to intellect, specifically, like if it harms your knee, say, so people get bad knees, or it harms your circulatory system. But this is mutations harmful to your intellect and your emotional functioning. They say we estimate two or more mutations that actually affect your intelligence.
That's right. And this author is actually, ironically and, you know, unwittingly confirming this himself by making a really dumb comment that in the future, we might be able to magically correct any mutation that has occurred in all the cells of any organism at any developmental stage.
I know.
Yeah. So instead of admitting that there's something wrong with his worldview, his theory of evolution.
Right. Because they think everything's getting better.
Go where the evidence leads you. Don't go in the opposite direction. And so we are getting dumber. Just look at the theory of evolution. How dumb is that?
Yeah. That is a good point. And I think even Hollywood is starting to figure out that if you do movies where people go into the future, they're not a lot more intelligent. They're way dumber, like dumber and dumber and dumber still. And you go further out. And so if you take a pothead today, take a couple potheads from a college campus and transport them to 1,000 years in the future, they're the Einsteins. They're the brilliant ones. Everyone else is as dumb as a rock. And that's where we're headed. Remember we did that show, Fred, about cavemen, the Real Science Radio caveman show.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was fun. We did a video, you and I,
yeah.
Dressed up like cavemen at Red Rocks.
Yeah.
That was,
I had a good time. Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Now, this is a fourth story, but it fits in. Researchers at the University of Budapest in Hungary, they examined artwork of animals, paintings, and even statues and carvings of animals that are running, and they looked specifically at horses, bulls, and elephants, and they found the most amazing thing when the animal, well, not necessarily running, but walking and trotting, and to look at the anatomical accuracy or inaccuracy of the artwork to see over time how have we been doing as far as accurately portraying in our art how animals move.
So how did Leonardo da Vinci's paintings, how did they match up against caveman paintings? Who won?
Well, you
so
think,
according to the theory,
right?
So if you had an evolutionary worldview, the caveman's going to be really
25,000 years ago or more,
grunt,
right?
Yeah, he's
dragging his woman around by the hair.
Yep.
Say, ooh, fire, fire,
yeah.
Ooh, fire. Woman, cook.
Yeah.
Cook breakfast.
What's wrong with that?
Well, so Fred, yeah, that's what they think. And so, of course, the caveman would be illiterate and certainly not anatomically observant.
Yeah. But lo and behold, they had a much lower error rate on depicting these animals
than Leonardo da Vinci and then modern artists. And when they look over this long period of time, they say, you know, it's startling. I saw a documentary on cave paintings just this past week. Fred, some of them are just amazing. And the most amazing ones are the ones that they say are older, which is so cool. You know, they're mostly in France and Spain. That's where they are.
Well, and you know, I remember on the back of the cover of one of these magazines was a painting that all the modern critics were saying, this is a really good piece of art. This is great work. And I'll tell you how dumb it was. A chimpanzee had done it pretty much randomly.
Yeah,
do you
right?
remember that?
Modern art.
Splash paint on a canvas, and they're like, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Our producer's doing that thing where you put your fingers together and you're checking out a painting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cheryl and I, with friends, we went to Italy, and we were in Florence.
Italy. Okay.
And, you know, the artwork there is just stupendous. And they had an exhibit of modern art in the square in the middle of the city. There's an exhibit of modern art. We could not get ourselves to stomach to go through it.
Well, I thought you said you couldn't get yourself out of there quick enough.
Well, we didn't even go
mirror.
In. Okay. We just looked at like the preview posters and we said, why would you go in there there's all this extraordinary Renaissance art? If I can do it, it's not art. They say, what is art? You know, if I can do it, it's not art. The talent of those that they called cavemen. They didn't live in caves. If they did, we would find the archaeological evidence of that.
Mm-hmm.
They went in caves, and they went in caves for specific reasons, including for some superstitious reasons, like getting close to the heart of Mother Earth so they could draw these animals and be prosperous when they go hunt, for example. You know, people say, why do the cave paintings, why are they just mostly in France and Spain? Well, why is Egyptian art mostly in Egypt, you know?
Yeah.
It's cultural. It's human beings becoming idiosyncratic in our cultural differences.
Yeah, what about our artistic nature with music? I mean, look at rap. I mean, come on. That's
well, I can't.
Yeah.
I can't.
Yeah.
My kids, you know, there's Christian rap.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, there is. I'm glad that you never heard of it.
Yeah, I haven't.
And my kids, bless them. And they know the words, and the words are very edifying. I can't take it.
Yeah.
I'm too old. I can't. It makes me sick. But my Christian music, when I was in the 70s, it made my parents sick.
Yeah, I know. That's true.
So
the rock and roll made our country music dad sick.
You don't sweat the small stuff. The cultural idiosyncrasies are not where you put your concern and you spend your moral capital. It's on the fundamental spiritual and moral issues. That's where you fight the battles.
That's right.
So this wonderful story explains that the cavemen had by far the highest accuracy rate. Leonardo da Vinci, he was sort of okay. In the 1800s, the European artists, they were not quite as good as da Vinci.
And Da Vinci, he wasn't some dumb guy, you know?
But no.
Hey, he wasn't as accurate as these Geico cavemen.
That's right.
So, Bob, you heard that I got a new job, the storage industry, a company up in Longmont.
Yes.
A big storage outfit that builds, for, among other things, those little flash drives that we put our stuff on.
Because you're a software engineer, as we all know.
How does storage compare to what God can do? Like on a single gram of DNA? So the Harvard scientists have smashed a record. Whose record? They maybe smashed human records.
But. Yeah. They're the guys who are storing data in DNA molecules.
That's right.
Hey, that's a good way to store data.
It is.
You can do that.
Yeah.
It's like a biological computer storage system.
Yeah, so they managed to get 5.5 petabits,
huh?
Which happens to be 700 terabytes. Terabytes, that's 1,000 gigabytes. So, at Costco, the biggest hard drive.
Wait, you just said 700 terabytes?
Yes.
In 1 gram?
In 1 gram.
A gram. You know, we have one of those metric scales at home because we're a homeschool family.
Yeah.
Our science lab. people think we're cutting crack cocaine or something. It's a science lab.
Yeah.
A gram, I always think of like a pea, a green pea,
yeah,
or a kernel of corn.
Okay.
About a gram. Little yeah bit. How much in 1 gram?
So 700 terabytes. Just so you know, at Costco, the biggest hard drive you can find, at least last time I checked,
at Costco,
a 3 terabyte hard drive.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's 3,000 gigabytes.
One, but, yeah, but 3,000 gigabytes.
And a gigabyte is 1,000 megabytes.
That's right.
And a megabyte is 1,000 kilobytes. And a kilobyte is 1,000 bytes.
That's, yeah.
So, and a byte is enough.
Yeah. It's more than we can chew. 3 terabytes is the biggest hard drive you can get right now.
Mm-hmm.
You would need 233 of those hard drives
yeah
to match what you can get in a gram of DNA. So
233 yeah of those hard drives. Wow.
In a gram.
In a pea.
In a pea.
The princess and the pea.
Yeah.
And there comes the pea again.
So can God design or what?
Yeah, God's good at these things.
Yeah.
Fred, the funny thing is the evolutionists for now 150 years of trying, they can't explain how the laws of physics and chemistry can produce information. There is no known way to take chemical reactions, physical reactions, and produce information. And all of life is information-based.
That's right. Yeah, so isn't God just the most awesome engineer ever? I mean,
yeah,
that's the record that yeah will never be broken.
He's worthy to be praised.
Absolutely.
So, Fred, thank you for co-hosting another episode of Real Science Radio. Our website, realscienceradio.com. And if you click on our store, that's the way you can get fabulous DVDs and debates, books on creation evolution, and you'll help us stay on the air at realscienceradio.com. We only stay on the air with your support. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYARTS. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist?, Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist?, and then Mount St. Helens, The Explosive Evidence for Catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYARTS, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realscienceradio.com, realscienceradio.com.